www.mediafree.tvpodcastnetwork.
When we first got out, pulled out at the light, Puff caught the light, and we did. And we were stopped at that light. The next thing you know, this car pulled up and just started firing shots in the car. Didn't yell, didn't say nothing. Just pulled up and we just heard shots.
Y'all crank up the car, please.
Y'all,
I'm ready to go.
Get out of here for real.
911 emergency, what are you reporting?
We're on Fairfax and Wilshire. We're man shot in our car right now.
This week, it's a biggie. A&E's The Life of Notorious B.I.G. and an oldie as Werner Herzog takes us back to 16th century Italy and ghosts with boomboxes in Gesualdo, Death for Five Voices. If music be the food of life, nobody told these guys. It's episode 22 of The Blotter Presents. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents. It's episode 22. I'm mangling Shakespeare quotes as I do every week. I'm Sarah D. Bunting. I'm your host. I couldn't think of anyone I'd rather have join me for a consideration of the larger than life and unsolved death of one of hip hop's giants. So my guest this week is my co-host on Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs. I'm speaking, of course, of About. Just kidding. It's Mark Blankenship. Hello, Mark.
But soft, what light through yonder window snakes?
It is the yeast. Let's just stop that right
and
there.
And Juliet is the bun.
Yeah, she sure is. And, oh God, I just thought of something disgusting to say. And for once, I stopped myself.
Let's Thanks, everyone. This has been a great episode, and we'll talk to you next time.
If you love this, you'll like Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs. Okay, this is a true crime on TV podcast, and we are talking this week of the several times delayed, actually, A&E joint Biggie, The Life of Notorious B.I.G. in our Most Wanted section. This show is premiering, it's a two-hour movie, it's premiering on Monday, that's Labor Day, September 4th, at 8 p.m. on A&E. I believe the network is following up with Who Killed Tupac sometime in the fourth quarter of this year. The timing of this one is a trifle odd, given that Biggie Smalls was murdered in March of 1997. And as true crime stories go, I was not 100 on the efficacy of this one, but overall, I enjoyed it. I thought it gave a good sense of place. I thought it had a lot of good talking heads with fancy people. I thought Puffy maybe got a little puffy, and it doesn't not suit him. Mark, what did you think of this film?
Well, you know, I suffered through the fictional Notorious B.I.G. film that came out a few years ago.
And oh, did you?
Yeah, okay. I watched it on a plane. Well, most of it. It was really bad. And so it was great to see this documentary, which was made with the cooperation of an executive producing credentials of Faith Evans, Biggie's widow, and of his mother, Mrs. Wallace, as everyone refers to her in the film. And I felt like this, because they had such access, this movie ended up feeling very complete and compelling in terms of creating a story of this really interesting guy. And I was completely absorbed by it for the whole 2 hours. And it wasn't until later that I started to think, this movie's biases are pretty clear in that it was made by people who loved him, and they understandably chose not to explore some parts of his life that a less sympathetic film might have pushed into. But on the whole, I didn't mind, because I felt like what this movie really created was a sense of what he meant as an artist, and more importantly, as a person, to the people in his life and in his community, both small and large. And I felt like I walked away with a much richer understanding of who he was and what his work and life had done to touch people and continue to do to touch people. So I'm really glad that I saw it.
Yeah, me too. I think it's good. It's worth watching because it gives you a sense of the man, and it does show a lot of compassion for the choices or the lack of choices that find, you know, young men in the game in Brooklyn at the end of the 80s and beginning of the 90s, as we're going to hear in clip two.
There was a lot of violence. It was like you could see crack vials spread everywhere. You would see people that you knew that would just turn skeletal. You didn't feel like anyone was in control.
Crack is such a menace in New York, the city has declared war on it. But finding crack is still easy. It took federal drug enforcement agents no more than 10 minutes in broad daylight.
There's a lot of money available and people at a very young age having to make these really heavy decisions about their life.
I thought that was a good, I think the movie does a good job sort of locating you in Wallace's life and how he came up, when he came up, how he sort of made the jump into hip hop, and that he was like a, he was like people's go-to dealer because he was basically like a chill guy. Like, it wasn't a matter of convenience. People would call him because they wanted to deal with him.
Right.
Which I thought was interesting that, like, if Yelp had existed, he would have had a 5-star review. And I also didn't, I forgot how many songs and tracks are his that are just braided into your life. What did you think of the choice to occasionally just do a break from one of his songs and have the lyrics on screen sort of in like graffiti font? Did you enjoy that, or did you think that was a little cheeso?
I really liked it because I don't know his songs that well, and seeing his poetry so become so present, instead of just having people talk about it, but actually seeing it and hearing it, because it's important too that we're always hearing him rap when the words appear on the screen.
Yeah.
To me, solidified what it was that he was doing. And there was that whole section of the film where they talk about the first album, Ready to Die, and how it's really a concept album about a drug dealer who ultimately has suicidal thoughts and evolves from being this braggadocious street king to being a guy who really wants to end his own life because he feels he has nothing. And I loved that I was able to see such clear examples of that on the screen and in people's interviews, because I only really knew his music through the story that the media told me, and they never mentioned that there was that kind of moral complexity in the music. They just stuck to, he's a gangster rapper, he wants to promote violence. You know, growing up where I did in the Southeast, that was just another way that white people could be afraid of black people. So, of course, that was the only element that got focused on. And then songs like Big Papa don't really get into the emotional complexity of the life and the community that he's exploring. So I feel like that having those lyrics on the screen made me appreciate that. But also, I just really liked being able to get a visual representation of what he was doing artistically with the rhythms and the beats and stuff. And so to me, it worked really well.
Yeah, I thought the like choice of fonts was maybe a little much, but it wasn't too bothersome. And it really, like, having the words on the screen, whatever the font, was really cool for me, because on a, you know, versification level, dramaturgically speaking, then I could really see the way that he was doing internal rhymes and sometimes cutting back to the same rhyme like two or three times in a single line. That was next level shit. And then you have all these people in talking heads talking about next level shit. And then there's a lot of like taped interviews that they use over, just sometimes with the footage of him, but sometimes just like footage of his block on Fulton Street, that you can tell what like a cool storyteller he was and what an ear he had for how a story is supposed to be built. Let's hear clip three for a quick example of that.
I've been on the streets since I was 13, 12 years old, man. I got beat up by police, everything, man. Everything a motherfucker imagine or see, I done been through that shit. If I ain't been through it, my closest nigga been through it. You know what I'm saying? It's all real, man. been in this hood for 22 years, yo. Same fucking block, same ass hood, man. Ain't nothing changed. Nothing. Niggas coming home from jail on some rah-rah shit, they going right back to jail or in a casket. This shit been happening since 86, 85, when I was a little nigga.
I mean, it's hard to explain why I think that's, like, good writing, because he's just talking and also, like, raging against the system that is just, like, looping young men of color, like, it, sort of on a, not assembly line, but, like, a tank track, basically, like, into jail, out of jail, into the graveyard. And, but he does it so efficiently, and it has this, like, tough, angry elegance to it that was, like, I don't know. Sometimes it's really hard in music documentaries, which I watch a lot of, because they tend to be super gossipy, and so am I. Sometimes it's hard to explain where the artistry is of a sound on film, and this does a really good job with that, I thought.
Totally. And, you know, you using the word gossipy points out for me one of the reasons I like this movie so much, in that it isn't gossipy. Instead, you get this community of voices all talking about art and meaning and struggle and trying to make some sense out of the chaos of the neighborhood that you hear described here. And that's so striking by the end of the movie that nobody, they talk about Lil' Kim, but they don't ever get into all of the shit that we always hear about Lil' Kim, right? They instead talk about Lil' Kim through the lens of, here's what she learned from Biggie, here's, like, and they talk about the fact that she was sleeping with him and he was cheating on Faith Evans.
Well, yeah, and then Faith Evans gets, like, one line where she's like, I didn't know any of that was going on, I didn't want to know, it's not what I'm here to talk about. So, fair. Like, they do with a kid, and she's trying to keep it, you know, classy, I guess.
And, like, there's something about the way that they deal with that, though, that even when they're talking about the infidelity, it isn't gossipy. It's just like, this was the context in which all of this was happening. And then I feel like it makes all of the people in the story that we meet, I know that they're real people, but you know what I'm saying, that makes them feel really human to me somehow. Like, the story where Faith Evans talks about going, flying across the country, going to the hotel just long enough to punch a girl in the face that Biggie was sleeping with, and then she leaves. Like, that story, the way that it comes across, makes Faith Evans seem amazing. And when they cut to all of the people that were there, like, the guys from the Junior Mafia, they're all like, yeah, that was awesome. And I just love that they all have this respect for each other, even though they also acknowledge that some shit was crazy, which I guess actually now would be a good time to call up the clip that I pulled, which is a really fascinating story that Jay-Z tells about what Biggie's music meant to him.
He was telling our story, you know, he was telling it in a way that was super clear, you know, like the angst and the frustration, you know, in three minutes and 30 seconds. It just changed your life. You listen to a song and you're like, oh man, your thinking changed. I remember hearing, and being broke at 30, give a nigga the chills. And thinking, oh, because I was, like, still almost in the life coming out, like, thinking about trying to be a rapper, playing with the idea of it, and seeing my friends go to jail 15 years, 20 years, this person get killed, and all our childhood friends, and then thinking, man, I can't be doing this at 30 years old. And so those sort of phrases change your entire life, really changed my life, like, literally made me say, okay, I gotta figure this out. I'm not saying that I wouldn't have arrived at this point, but if I had 99 things, that was the 100th one that just pushed it over and said, yes, I gotta go and I gotta do this. And I know he's done that for countless people.
And he's talking right before that about the people who would hear Biggie and be like, okay, I give up. Like, I thought maybe I was an MC, but I ain't shit. So I thought that was funny too.
Right.
Yeah. Does give a really good, I like it. I like dealing with Jay-Z in the culture as like an expert witness.
Right.
And not as this like super couple icon guy. Like, he knows what he's talking about. So every time I see him in a documentary, I'm like, sweet. 'Cause he knows so much shit, and so does Puff.
Right. Oh my gosh, Puff, who really comes across as being exceptionally savvy. I mean, clearly he was. You don't build a decades-long music empire without being savvy.
Yeah.
But there's just something about actually hearing him without the veneer of it being on making the band, right? Where he's always like, you've got to walk across the Brooklyn Bridge and get me cheesecake because artists have to be dedicated.
Diddy
like,
blog, all, diddy know. Blog. Oh, God. I miss that show so bad.
But, we know, without all of that, and it's just talking about things that he knew and things he knew had to be done, and when he was able to convince Biggie to make the song Juicy, which is like, Biggie didn't want to make the song Juicy, then you're right, Puffy is a genius, because that song is the shit. I really liked hearing all of that, too. And like you said, Puffy has gotten puffy in his middle age, but...
He looks good.
Like, he looks good, and honestly...
If you follow us on Twitter, at Blotter Presents, which you should, there will be some pictures from this fine film, including a vintage snap of Puff and Biggie, and Puff has this, like, curly high-top fade that is gorgeous. I'm just like, how did you even do that? I mean, he sort of looks, you know, he looks utterly mid-90s, but, like, it's Puff, so it still looks cool. And I also wanted to mention that in our opening clip, I included the part where the guy's like, you know, Puff made the light and we didn't make the light. And Puff has this way, just metaphorically in his life, of always making the light when others don't. Like the club fire, like that this relationship with Biggie Smalls and sort of East Coast, West Coast, like it did make him basically. Mm-hmm. So, I think he was legit destroyed by his friend's death, but he's Puff, so he always comes out, he always rises.
And he made, his longest running number one hit was the tribute song that he made to the tune of Every Breath You Take.
Which could not get away from 20 years ago.
Oh, good luck going to the mall, the Taco Bell, the car wash, your aunt's house, your dog sitter, anything, everywhere. It's just, I'll be missing you, white suit, pointing at the camera. Oh, that reminds me, before we go, speaking of, before we go, we're not, what?
I know, okay, bye.
Before we move on. So, y'all, I've got banana bread in the oven. No, I don't. Although, I wish I did.
No, me too.
Speaking of being an expert witness, I do want to point out, and this is crucial. I feel like this is one of the reasons it was important for me to be here today. When I was a junior in high school in the spring of 1996, so I would have been 17, I was in Nashville participating in Model Youth Legislature at the Tennessee State Capitol. I was a lobbyist, quote unquote. I was in an elevator with my friend Sam, who was also there. I can't remember what he was doing. But in the elevator in our Nashville hotel, on steps, the notorious B.I.G. And it was him and some other guy. He was wearing a cable knit sweater, very similar to the ones you see him wearing throughout this film. And when he got off at his floor, the wave of pot smoke that came onto the elevator when the doors opened on his floor was out of control. And Sam and I, neither one of us said anything, but when he left and the doors closed, we both went, was that the Notorious B.I.G.? And it was really the coolest thing. So I feel, having been in proximity to the man and his pastimes, I feel that I have, well, honestly, nothing to offer, but I just wanted to make sure that I mentioned that I actually was in an elevator with Biggie in 96.
That is great. Puff used to have a townhouse around the corner for me, like 20 years ago. I never actually saw him, so you're doing better than me. And I think either of us could probably do better than this movie does at addressing. I mean, I thought they did a good job with, like, the feud itself and what happened to drive a wedge between Biggie and Tupac Shakur. They did a less good job with Biggie's death. And I'm not sure exactly why this is, but I have a couple of theories. First, let's listen to clip 5.
Once Suge Knight got involved, once Death Row got involved, then it became a completely other thing. It became a war. And a lot of that really started at the Source Awards.
And then they'd sort of go on to show what was happening at the Source Awards and the like booing and sort of dick measuring from the podium and stuff like that. But this is where in the movie I had to pause it and do a little background reading online about what we know or think we know about these murders 2 decades later. And P.S., sometimes it really feels like these two men died only a few years ago. Like, it's pretty shocking to me that it's been 20 years. I'm not sure how that happened. But I do get the sense, like, once Suge Knight got involved, then nobody is going to be talking in the presence of any recording device. So I think that's part of it. I think part of it is that they wanted to make a movie about his life that wasn't overtaken by his, you know, the circumstances of his death. I think that's a smart call.
Right.
I'm running a true crime podcast and it was a little frustrating. Did you feel that they didn't address that because they just didn't have the material, or that it was a conscious choice to kind of stay away from like trying to crime solve and stick to his life and influence?
I think the second, it definitely how it comes across to me, because I feel like otherwise it would become that Courtney Love, Kurt Cobain movie that came out a few years ago,
or, yeah,
you know, I feel like it would have become very tawdry, and they still make it very clear who they think did it. I mean, like, because this movie is executive produced by Faith Evans and Mrs. Wallace, which, sidebar, I love her in this movie. And
so do
I love the intense respect that everyone still has for her. Faith Evans, everyone who mentions her, the guy from the Cease, the guy from the Junior Mafia, everyone still refers to her as Mrs. Wallace. And that tells you everything you need to know about this woman and the influence that she had on the people around her, which
and
I love.
Looking at her standing in front of that beautiful building, I think it's on St. James, that is just the mural of him with the crown on, and she's in like head to toe fur coat. It's really something. And then they have this crane shot where they pull away and you see kind of all of Brooklyn, and then he's gigantic because it's the whole side of a building, but he's also small, which was really a great visual. Actually, we have one more clip from The Life of Notorious B.I.G., and it is Mrs. Wallace talking about that she wants an arrest. That's all she wants. That's clip 6.
I'm absolutely convinced that Suge Knight was behind the murder of Biggie Smalls. And I challenge anybody to try to disprove that.
My mission is for all the authorities that were involved to make an arrest. They know the truth.
To make an arrest.
An arrest.
If I'm LAPD, even all the way across the country, this little old lady, I hear that pronunciation and I'm like, we're reopening the file. Let's get this shit done. She's
right.
Great.
But, you know, it's interesting because my takeaway from the movie is so much more about what you were saying. Let's focus on his life. And honestly, let's focus on the after effect of his death, the support that came from the community, but also her grief becomes such a focal point at the end of the film. And the way that she speaks about feeling sorry for the people who did this because of what it must mean about who they are inside. I guess to go back to what I was saying before about the humanity of this movie and the kindness and the love, I really appreciated it. Now, from a true crime perspective, it is fairly thin soup, but the story that it's telling is very different than the story I'm used to hearing, because it does remind you that there are families and people and friends connected to this who still care about each other very deeply. And I feel like because the story of Tupac and Biggie got spun by the media to be so much about an entire culture,
yeah, totally.
Tupac and Biggie became these avatars for hip hop and for Black America and all this other stuff. And the movie does ding the media for doing that. But because that's what they became, to see it irised down again, back to them as just people, was really refreshing.
And yeah, it totally does. And to Wallace himself as a titan and sort of a pioneer in the genre, which he definitely was, it was really cool to spend all that time with his music and be like, this is why we are still talking about him, or should be.
Right.
So That was pretty great. And she, you know, you wonder if he got some of his ear for phrasing from her, because earlier in the movie, when she talks about his birth, she talks about it as the day that she met him, which I just thought was wonderful. It was like, well, you gave birth to him, but that's also true. She, yeah, I mean, that gift did not come from nowhere. Like, he definitely taught himself how to actually do it. And it's not like she sort of didn't engage with his art until after his death, when she was like lying on top of a speaker, sort of realizing that her dead son was a genius, which, I mean, it really, I got emotional watching that. She's really amazing as a storyteller. So I think he got some of that from her too.
Absolutely.
All right. So that was a wonderful story. Again, that's airing Labor Day, September 4th at 8 p.m. on A&E. And I recommend it. I thought it was a really good way to spend 2 hours. And I think that either music documentaries or just documentaries, it's solid. True crime, not so much, but it's still really good.
Yeah.
And now to the bonkers portion of our program. Our cold case today, our cold case property today, aired on German public television in 1995 concerning a crime that occurred in 16th century Italy. This is a piece directed by Werner Herzog for German television. Mark, please take the listeners through how we got to Gesualdo, Death for Five Voices.
My pleasure. So when I knew that we were going to be on this episode together and that Biggie was the focal point of the first section, I asked my husband, Andrew, who is a vocal coach to musical theater performers, but also has a lot of training in classical music, if there were any classical music related murders that might make for interesting discussion on this show. And the first thing he said was, oh, Gesualdo. He was insane. He killed his wife and her lover. He's the most famous murderer in classical music history. And then I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. I wonder if there's ever been a television show about Gesualdo. Then I Googled it and found this Werner Herzog movie. And then I found that the entire thing, which is 59 minutes, is on YouTube. And then I said that we should watch it. And then I watched it. And then my head turned inside out. I briefly became a snake, a pig, and a gust of wind, and now I'm back, ready to talk to you about it best I can.
My notes are like all capital letters, like, and then she turns on a boombox. I mean, it's very Herzog, but let's begin with a clip, which is how, accompanied by a slow pan across a valley to the town of Gesualdo's ancestral castle, this is how we are introduced to the man and his compositions in clip 7. No, that was not one of us breathing heavily into the mic. That was the pointed thunder included by Herzog's sound designer. They spend a lot of time in Death for Five Voices with performing his songs and talking about how he was also a visionary, and that there were things in his music that prefigured Wagner. Like, I don't know nearly enough about classical music to say, but I enjoyed it. I like this kind of music. I found it very, you know, it was affecting. I liked it.
So another thing that we should clarify, because everything about this movie is so insane, it's not just that people are performing his madrigals. It's that we see a group of singers sitting in uncomfortable looking folding chairs in a circle wearing what looked to be their best LA gear fashions. And they're basically seemed like they just rolled in from the mall and were like, oh, we'll start singing. And then every now and then, the guy who's conducting the madrigal will look meaningfully at the camera as though we're supposed to understand what that means. And it just, like everything else in this movie, is completely destabilizing. And I love and
same.
Fear
there is
it
also
the
a sequence where, I mean, in addition to the lady whose breasts we are seeing almost in their entirety, who says that she is the reincarnation of Maria, the wife who was killed.
Yes, Jez Waldo's
she picks up a little,
wife.
You know, like late round lady boombox from the mid-90s to, you know, to play some of the music for us, but then she hits the wrong track. So she has to, and they left it in.
And they don't. And what's amazing is that she hits the wrong track and she ad-libs in character as Jez Waldo's dead wife's ghost and is like, oh, I have chosen the wrong, and then they just leave it in.
And then we see 5 minutes
I actually
this boy with intellectual delays or some kind of mental illness, I guess, learning yeah. to ride a horse, which was so
riding
sweet.
On a horse.
But then they cut in the foreground to some doctor who's like, well, you know, I can't show you any more of Francesco's riding lesson. But I can tell you that we've had a couple of patients here who thought they were Carlo Gesualdo and we had to keep them separate so they didn't kill each other. Like, why did we just see equine therapy it goes on for a while. Like, look, I like horses, but fuck's sake.
Forever.
Cut.
I was so relieved when I read up about this movie that parts of it were just purely fictionalized because it comes across as so stagey and I'm like, okay, thank God. But then at the same time, apparently the story of Jez Waldo murdering his wife and her lover wasn't interesting enough. So there's also all of this weird mystical occult stuff that gets added in. I mean, I'm not mad about it because this is a very entertaining
don't
59
forget
minutes.
I don't know what these people do. They appear to be cooks who are married to each other. Is this
who work in
Castile Gesualdo. And he is reading the wedding menu. And the wife is like ranting that he is il diavolo for forcing his chefs to make like 200 trays of baked oysters. Like she's enraged by this.
She says the word diavolo about 50 times.
I think you might be underestimating that, actually. But yeah, I mean, so he murders his wife and her husband, and then there's like another wife, and then apparently he was flagellated to death by servants.
Yeah, that's what they tell us. But again, honestly, I don't know what's real and what isn't in this movie, but that's the story they're going with. Oh, speaking of not knowing what's real, there's also this really nerdy British music historian who tells us a story about people who studied Jez Waldo and how they all went crazy, including this little bit of trivia.
Philip Heseltine, who was an English scholar, better known by his pseudonym of Peter Warlock, became so involved with Jez Waldo, he edited a lot of the music. It was he that first saw it as a kind of prefiguring of Wagner. He got so involved, he actually thought he was Jez Waldo and became so deranged he committed suicide. So Jez Waldo has all sorts of influences even now across the centuries.
So Peter Warlock was real. That was he did, in fact, Philip Heseltine did take on the name Peter Warlock to signal his interest in the occult. He did do a lot of studying of Jez Waldo, and he did commit suicide. But from what I can gather, Jez Waldo had nothing to do with the suicide. But who knows? Honestly, again, what? Great. I don't know.
I mean,
tell me more.
We hear this guy a lot in our clips because the rest of it is Italian with subtitles. There will be a link in the show notes. You can watch it on YouTube. You can just turn on the captions. It's an hour so well spent. Like, it's so baffling. And I really have to urge you, listeners, even if you don't care about classical music or Italy or Herzog or this podcast, do yourselves a favor, watch it, and then do me a favor. Come to the forums at previously.tv/forums because we need to talk about this with someone besides each other because we're starting to think that we imagined it.
Just to confirm, No, just to confirm that it actually happens. Like, I need a third opinion that tells me that the lady who plays the wrong CD track is real.
Also, speaking of why were these takes left in, here's our British music history nerd once again, desperately needing a glass of water, but apparently not permitted to have another take until he gets through the first one in clip 9.
Methodically, cynically, he devised a plan whereby he said he was going to go hunting. He changed the locks in the palace so that he would be able to burst in the most spectacular fashion. And this is what he did. Returning from his hunting trip early, he came with 3 men. They burst in, they killed Carathar, armed with arquebuses and spears. They shot him, they ran him through. And then Gesualdo himself followed and murdered the poor unfortunate Maria with a dagger. He wasn't convinced he'd done the job properly. On the way out, he said to one of the servants, "I can't believe she's dead." And he rushed back in and stabbed her 28 more times. The picture is made even more odd by the fact that Fabrizio Carafa was wearing a lady's nightgown covered in lace that she'd given him. So the end of this particular story is that the bodies were left by Gesualdo at the bottom of the steps, or so we're told, and they were despoiled by a passing monk.
You know, as passing monks do. Like, there's a lady's nightgown, there's the fact that, and like, I guess he's sort of looking at the camera like, can I get a seltzer? And Herzog's like, not till you get to the despoiling, buddy. Oh my god, like, I know the Renaissance was like, this is just another day at the office for your average minor Medici. Like, none of this is that shocking, but it's that like weird Herzog-y take on it that's so bizarre. Like, I had a little snippet from the film's Wikipedia page that I wanted to read. Do you mind?
Oh no.
The final scene of a Renaissance fair performer talking with his mother on a cell phone was also staged for the camera. Herzog instructed his brother, standing just off camera, to call the young man and for the man to act like his mother was asking him to come home. The young man was then instructed to stare seriously into the camera, and this footage was used during the end credits. To elicit the strange stare that the man gives, Herzog instructed him to look very serious, but then played around and made various jokes right next to the camera as soon as he started filming. Herzog used a similar direction for scenes of his earlier Even Dwarfs Started Small. There's absolutely no point to that Renaissance scene either. Like, you're watching some joust, like you're at a rent fair.
No.
It's whatever. And the costumes are dollar store at best, or a store d'allore. I mean, whatever. This movie is so weird. It's so Herzog, and apparently it's like one of his pets. He loves this project.
Yeah, it's closest to his heart, as he was saying.
My God. You get
at
to
some
see
point.
Like semi-mummified skeletons that may or may not be the dead people.
That scene is amazing, where it's like, yes, in this house are the bodies of the dead. And then also he completely concocted that story about the artifact with the weird sketches on it.
Yeah. And then there's that guy who's like, I'm Gesualdo. Just kidding. I'm a like music historian, and I'm just going to play some chords for you that indicate that he presaged Brahms or something. I couldn't even follow that. I was just like, this is the most wonderful, ridiculous thing I ever saw in my life.
And, you know, it is the confidence with which he makes this film that makes it so wonderful, because the movie is just batshit crazy, but it's so confident that I am completely seduced by it. I want to keep watching it, even though it does not hold up under the slightest bit of scrutiny, because really, ultimately, it isn't about Gesualdo. It's really about whatever Werner Herzog was thinking about in that moment. Sometimes it was Gesualdo.
And I think maybe he's just like, you know, I like this music and I'd like an excuse to like have a lot of montages of the Neapolitan countryside. Like, all right, sure. I'm in. I like the Neapolitan countryside, I think. Oh boy. Well, Mark and Andrew, thank you so much for bringing this into my life. Once again, it's called Gesualdo, Death for Five Voices. It's utterly bizarre, and it's on YouTube, and you'll be able to find it in our show notes. Mark, where else can listeners find you?
Well, listeners, you can find me along with Sarah at Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs, which is our pop music podcast. And you can find that on the podcast provider of your choice, or you can just Google the phrase Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs and you'll find us really quickly. You can also discover more of my writing, filmmaking, and other theatrically minded work at ShowScore, which is a site that I just recently started working for that is to theater fans what ESPN is to sports fans. Find ShowScore at show-score.com and keep your eyes peeled in the next few months for a variety of exciting video and written projects.
Excellent. Mark, thank you so much for joining me today and every week on Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs. You can follow this podcast on Twitter at Blotter Presents. You can find us on Facebook at Blotter Presents. You can find me on Twitter at Tomato Nation. Next week, we're going to be off for a while, or not a while, just a week, but enjoy Labor Day and come visit us on the forums, previously.tv/forums, to suggest future topics for future episodes. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and this has been The Blotter Presents.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.